So to begin the debate, I turn to James Bevan to move the case for the proposition.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and if you call James, I should be pleased. You call Shane, I should assume it was James, and you just couldn't quite articulate the word properly after dinner. I have to tell you, I cheated a little bit. I came in, Robert's giving these fine wooden boxes containing cigars, and I thought it'd be fun to have one. There's nothing in this box whatsoever. This box, in contrast, I have to tell you, there's something really interesting in it. And I know I'm using up my time, but who'd have guessed? Sitting in the Oxford box. Anyway, enough said on that. But it's quite an important point, because that little rubber cock is all about trying to look good, I suspect, rather than doing good. And you might think, well, haven't we all therefore already lost the plot, lost the case, and aren't you going to say shame and resign? But I want to move away from the short-term easy jokes and talk about actually the profound importance of the motion that the House believes there is nothing wrong with spending more on looking good than doing good. Now, the motion itself, I find surprisingly ambiguous, and I suspect it's intentionally so, because it is requiring us to think very carefully about the notions of what is wrong, what is spending, what is looking good and doing good. So if I begin with the premise that we need to talk about what is good and what is not good, we move immediately into the field of ethics and aesthetics. We are dealing immediately with the challenge that there is something inherently right or wrong about being able to make a choice. So for me, this is not an issue of either or, this is a question of and. Can we not do things that both look good and which do good? Need they be in conflict, and need we be judgmental about whether one is inherently better than the other? So I remove the premise that we should not be axiomatic about the premise that it is inherently wrong to spend more on looking good than it is doing good. I would say that we need to be conditional in our assessment of what is good and what is not good, and also conditional in terms of who is looking and who is doing and what are the outcomes of both. I think there is then the practical and fundamental reality that if we direct how society should behave, then actually we have given up on the challenges to democracy, freedom and the rule of law, which binds us in British society and allows each and every individual to determine the extent to which they devote their resources, their energies and their time to either looking good or doing good. I would further suggest that if we were to define behaviour such that we denied people the capacity to spend on looking good, then we may actually reduce net societal benefit, because it is not the case that if we deny people the opportunity to behave in one way that is not, as we perceive it, optimal, that necessarily they will behave in the way that we would prefer. So it could be that there is a net loss from saying that people have to do good rather than look good. I also go on and question this issue about what exactly is being spent. Now, spending is a process by which something is used. But need it necessarily be about cash? Need it necessarily be monetized? No, shame, because you're playing on your phone and I ought to be listening to it. That's very fine, spending this time not listening to me. I'm sure the dogs will there we go. I will carry on. And I would like to say that, therefore, when we think about what is being spent, we need to distinguish between money and time and indeed people's lives. And if we are going to raise the stakes and talk about how people spend their lives, how people give their lives, then we need to be very clear about what we mean by looking good and doing good. So to me, when we think about looking good, I'm not talking about whether one looks fabulous, whether you all look gorgeous and glorious. I'm talking about a much more deep level of looking good in the eyes of the Lord, looking good in the context of being seen to be doing the right thing. And I do think that if we are going to require certain joy in a momentum, in a shared vision, in something that can gather pace and create better outcomes, then being seen to be counted, standing together, is a critical part of what motivates society to move together. I then think that we need to think quite carefully about what we mean by good, and I was spending some time trying to understand what the great philosophers have said about good, and I came across the works of Immanuel Kant. I have to say they're quite boring for those who've not read them, but if you have read them, you'll be aware. But what Kant says is that good is essentially a cultural idiom. It is a choice, it is a set of values that are unique and specific. And if it is the case, therefore, that the definition of good is something that we must define for ourselves, and here we are in Oxford, we need to think carefully about what we think good might mean within the context of debating here in the Oxford Union, and whether or not looking good and doing good in that frame is something that is necessarily better or less worthwhile. I find it very revealing that the Oxford Union was built and prospered just as the Oxford movement in the Anglo-Catholic tradition was also beginning to become more substantial and to wield more influence. And this was a period where there was a great sense that we needed to be broader in our assessment of how we might move society. And I would argue that actually this was a period when that very strong Victorian sense of cultural imperialism, through the act of doing, created a lot of the misery that was the result of the invasive empire behaviours of the 19th century. So I want to look back beyond the Anglo-Catholic traditions of the 19th century, both to the purer sense of Christian tradition and being seen to do good in the eyes of the Lord, but also the premise that you have to love yourself before you can love others, and the premise that therefore you need to remove the beam from your own eye before looking at the most in others is of critical significance. But earlier than that, there was Cicero, and Cicero made some very interesting comments about ethics and aesthetics, and he argued that ethics were about obligation. Doing things was simply getting things done. There was no real merit in doing. However, the aesthetics of choice, the aesthetics of how you do things, he argued were more important for society. And against that background, I do think that it is critically important to recognise that if we accept that there is nothing inherently wrong with spending more on looking good than doing good, then you should absolutely support the motion that against that backdrop, society is better off by trying to find a means by which looking good and doing good together can bear greater fruit. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your time.
I thank the Honourable Guest for his speech, and before we continue with the other debates, the other speeches I should say, I realise that I passed over a very important part of the proceedings. So before we continue, can I please pass over to the CEO of the Oxfordshire Community Foundation, Jane Woodley, to say a few words.
Hilarious, isn't it? Because I am now officially a speaker of the Oxford Union. I am in the debate. The idea was I was not mentioning, so we don't care about that. What I wanted to say was just to welcome you. It hasn't been possible to say hi to everyone, but you are really, really very welcome, and it is a privilege for us all to be here. Hopefully, Charlie said he's going to lather it up, whatever that means. I think that's Oxford Union speak. But what I want to say is, I know for many of you this is a really unique experience and you will never have been in this chamber before. But for me, that's not the reason that we're here. The reason for me is a lot more philosophical, as my daughter would say. It's because I think it's a shared opportunity for us all to open up our hearts and minds and actually think about how we choose to spend our time and money. You've heard from my eminent colleague over there, you know, lots of philosophers talk about this, but I think generally we don't talk about it enough. Maybe we find it embarrassing, or maybe it's just something we find difficult. And that's where the community foundations come in. And I guess that a lot of you in this room probably don't know what a community foundation is, so I'm just going to, if you allow me, indulge myself to tell you a little bit about community foundations. We've been going about 100 years, and here in Oxfordshire, we're nearly 21, celebrating a big birthday next year. And the OCF, as we like to call ourselves, is, there are 48 of us across the UK, and we do have some other community foundations in the audience, so you're all very welcome. But we're one of 1,700 around the world. Now, I think that suggests that we're doing something right, and we're definitely not alone. So what do community foundations do, and what makes us unique? The first thing is we actually like to identify what the needs are in our areas, and more importantly, we bring together the people that have the resources to actually do something about them. We then like to magnify things that we think are real problems and tell people about them, which is why we're having this debate tonight, because I think people don't talk about this stuff enough. And then the other thing we do, which is the real fun bit, is we match people that actually share what I would call this social responsibility for the common good. And whilst we've been talking about looking good and doing good, I actually think it's all about the common good. So what do community foundations do? In the last year alone, we've actually funded 20,000 charities up and down the country, all throughout the UK. We've awarded £65 million of money in grants. That's community investments, we like to see it. And between us, we look after nearly £500 million of charitable funds on behalf of individuals, families, and businesses. So, as I will keep saying, you know, I think that's a real sign that we're really interested in the common good. But the one thing that my team and I worry about every day is that not enough people think about the common good. And boy, do we need the common good at the moment. So I'm just going to ask you just to close your eyes, look around the people next to you. Maybe you know some of the faces, maybe you don't. But I figure we're sort of 350 in here. Now, if you close your eyes and double that number, that's the amount of people in Oxfordshire that are actually homeless. That's not in some faraway city like London or any other part of the world. That's here on our doorstep. And we think that's a problem that we all need to be talking about. It's just one of the problems. It's not the only one, there are loads more. And I'm not in the debate, so I can't keep talking about it. But the real thing that I think matters is that you're like me, and you do care, because that's why you're here from the start. You wouldn't have come if you weren't particularly interested. So I'm just going to ask for a little bit of help, really. We're going to talk about Christmas, and then 44 sleeps to Christmas. Yeah. Maybe for some of you that's 1,050 online shopping hours, or the shopping can get done. And you're all going to be asking for things and buying things. So I'm going to say, there's a little envelope in your pack. And what I want is actually a little letter from all of you. Maybe some of you will do it, maybe some of you won't. But what I really want to know is how you feel about this stuff. So I don't want a Christmas wish list, I just want you to tell me, what did you think about the motion before you started? When you leave, will you have thought differently? What could we be doing to help? What things really bother you about when you look around your communities? Do you see things that are problems? Do you want to do something to change them? Because I believe you do, I really do. One of the things that I learned last week is even more incredible was that County Durham Community Foundation have just signed the most amazing deal with Burberry. So Burberry, that iconic British band, they have launched a fantastic festive ad campaign, Elton John, Romeo, Beckham, and actually alongside that, they've put in a piece of philanthropy and they've made a huge significant gift, it's £250,000, to their local community, which is all about the Billy Elliot legacy, and they've chosen the Community Foundation to do that with as a partner. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. And that is talking about the common good. That's a corporate doing some great work. Now, a little bit closer to home and to my heart is another corporate that's making this evening possible. We've already heard from James. I'm also going to introduce him as one of our eminent speakers. You might have known that he often appears on national TV, on the radio, often really early in the morning for those of you who get up. But CCLA sort of enabled us to turn this pipe dream into the event that we have tonight. So we really couldn't do it without them. For those of you that don't know, and you may be wondering, what does CCLA stand for? It just stands for the three types of clients that they have, which are charities, charities, churches, and local authorities. But more importantly, we are really grateful because you have made it possible. Now the next speaker is obviously getting over the anxious, and I am going to stop. We've had such fun in the office working with the speakers. They've shown such good humour, they've been really generous, they're all giving their time for free, and we couldn't have done it without them. So we're just dying to hear what you've all got to say. So thank you. I'm going to hand back now to the President, and we'll go back to order.
Thank you, Jay. I now look to Danny Dorling to move the case for the opposition.
Ladies and gentlemen, you don't need to spend a very large amount of money on yourselves to love yourselves. I find myself in a strange position today because I'm not normally somebody who argues for large amounts of charity funding for the kind of normal do-gooding arguments in society, but I'm not opposed to them, but that isn't my normal stance. However, I do worry about the amount of money that people are now spending on their appearance to try to make themselves feel better about themselves. I think it has escalated to a point where we need to control it again, and we need to think how we could use that money in such better ways. The kind of things you spend money on, it's not just cosmetics or expensive haircuts. It's buying clothes at a higher rate than clothes are bought in many other similar countries. The average item in the UK of clothing is only worn 12 times. We can calculate that quite easily. You are enticed by advertising. Advertising spend in this country is twice what it is in the rest of Europe. You're enticed to think that if you go out and spend more on yourself and your appearance, you will feel happier about yourself. It will help you. This clearly makes money for people involved in the cosmetic and the fashion industries. But does it actually make you love yourself more? Or does it make you worry about yourself more? Now, we all worry about our appearances. Some of us slightly more than others. I put on this very special jacket today, coming to talk to you. Just a small piece of advice. Forget Bicester, Swindon, MacArthur Glen outlet, £75. We are not arguing about creating a totalitarian state where we say, you shall not do this, you shall do this. The question is, have we got to a point where people, and particularly young people, are becoming so obsessed with their appearance that it is actually damaging their lives? And it would be in their own selfish interests to spend a little bit less on themselves and their own appearance, and a little bit more on doing good in the many ways in which you can do good. And there are numerous ways in which you need to do good. And you can just start locally. And when you start, we've heard of the 750 people who are homeless in the county. You can come down to this city. In this city, in that direction, in Oxford West, if I've got my geography right, it'd be very embarrassing if I haven't. Oxford West and Amidon, 2,000 children are living in poverty. Oxford East, about 5,500. A quarter of all children in this city are living in poverty. In a city which also has incredible wealth and affluence in it, there are school teachers who bring in food to their schools to give out to the children who are hungry in this city, at the same time as we have food that isn't being eaten on the tables in many of the colleges in this town. There are many terrible things that you can worry about. There are many, many groups who are advocating about this, and if you want to spend a little less on some item or another, that money could be used for that good. Now, I was brought up in Oxford, and if you were brought up in Oxford in the 1980s, the set text for O-level English was Down and Out in London and Paris. And if you read Down and Out in London and Paris, when you got to the very end of it, you heard the missive from George Orwell saying, whatever you do in life, do not give money to the Sally Army. Because there are arguments against do-gooding. You do need to worry about what the good is, and is it really good, and is it really helping? But I don't think any of you would oppose the idea that it is good to try to do good. But let's go back to the idea of beautifying ourselves more and more and more. I had a friend, when I left this city and went to Newcastle to university, I met a friend on my first day who was studying dentistry. It was his first day of studying dentistry, and he was a little bit shocked. He'd come from an area near Huddersfield, from a family who'd come over from Pakistan, and he decided that he wanted to study dentistry because he wanted to stop people's teeth hurting. He was shocked, and this was in 1986, to find that so many of his fellow students were not that worried about pain and teeth, but much more interested in cosmetic dentistry, even then, in helping people whiten their teeth, in making money in dentistry in a different way. He qualified as a dentist, despite the fact that his first 10 years of life were leading a ox around a well in Pakistan, and then qualified as a doctor, and became a maxillofacial surgeon in Manchester. And every day, he reconstructs people's faces who are in car accidents in the northwest of England. That is incredibly important. That is the kind of looking good we have to worry about. But the more money we spend as a society on making ourselves look good cosmetically, the less it actually benefits us, and the more we begin as we age to look slightly strange. We're not yet at the state of the Americans, but it doesn't actually make you look good spending a lot of money trying to look good. For those youngsters in the audience, you are all beautiful anyway. But you do need somebody to tell you that, because the ages at which people are most obsessed with how they look is between around about 14 and around about 28. And there are obvious, maybe biological reasons why that is. It's very interesting. Social class actually stops being a key issue in young people's lives. And hot or not, you know, and appearance and acne and all the rest of it rises in terms of anxiety. But it goes again. I can tell you, the worries about how you look really do go with time. We need to worry less about how white and how straight our teeth are. We need to not inject our faces with poisons to paralyse them so we can look a little bit younger for a few more years. A bit of modest spending on ourselves is fine, but if you find that you're spending more on your appearance and how you look than anything else, you are veering towards being narcissistic. And narcissism is a disorder. I'm putting it very bluntly. We need to put a cap on this and a control on it. Because if you just go forward from what was normally my childhood to what is now normally my children's childhood, and it carries on, and the women get thinner and thinner, and there are more and more likes on people's Facebook picture of how wonderful it supposedly is. And I think about my potential grandchildren's lives, this is not a direction of travel we want to go in. So I very much hope that you're going to oppose the motion. Thank you very much.
I thank the honourable guest for his speech, and now turn to Nigel Mercer to continue the case to the proposition.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I am Daniel in the Lion's Den. I am your plastic surgeon. There will be those out there who hate me, although you never met me. Because of what Daniel said, you have an inbuilt, visceral dislike of me and what I do. and hopefully the next 7 or 8 minutes I will change that a bit. First of all, one of the things about being a plastic surgeon is when I talk to students at school about what we do and to medical students, I say, what do I do every day of my life? And Danny's alluded to that with his colleague in Manchester who I have very similar working life to. Every day of my working life, I go and stab the public, and by and large, they say thank you, and I don't get arrested. And that does make surgeons interesting people. So I would like to hold that thought in your head. Unfortunately, we are biologically programmed to like attractiveness. We are, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, despite being a beautiful building with wonderful surroundings, we are animals. We've only been humans for a relatively short period of time. And inside your brain, if all of you watch Spectre, the new Bond movie, you know there's a gyrus in here. If you put a drill into that, you cannot see beauty. It is actually in your brain. And within architecture, this building probably about 50 meters of divine proportion, which has been known since the time of the pyramids. 1.618, etc., etc., etc. And it's the proportion that makes everything look beautiful to the human brain. And it's in the pyramids, it's in Notre Dame, it's all around us, and it's in the human face. And the one thing that we need to remember is that we've known that since Leonardo's time, we've known it since time immemorial. The most beautiful face, the most beautiful body, is one of the face of the human. That is not real. It is actually an artifact of his brain. So I'm afraid to say attractiveness is what allows you to pass your genes to the next generation. You only have to watch David Attenborough, his current programme about the heart. We are unfortunately animals, and therefore we will want to be the best of anything we can do. We want to be the most attractive. If you look at some of the programmes we've done in the last 40 years, the attractive animal gets the best mate. And that is what we are, afraid. We are animals. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that that's where we should focus, because we are now higher beings. We are able to think more. And I think I would agree with the speakers who said on my side that you need a balance between this, but you certainly should not disparage the looking good bit. If you look back to history, Albrecht Dürer was one of the first, the famous German artists. In the 1500s, he actually worked out the ideal female form for his generation, for his world. It wouldn't fit the bill nowadays, but I think that's where we're going to come to advertising a little bit later, and I will talk about advertising towards the end of this. If you look at urban populations now, a third of the income of an urban population is spent on looking good. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is from your toothbrush to what you put on your hair. Having your hair cut. It is not just about cosmetic plastic surgery. Now, unfortunately, plastic surgery in your mind probably means cosmetic surgery. Now, it does. Plastic surgery started 100 years ago with the battle injuries in the carnage of the First World War, where we celebrated the start of our specialty this last summer, Passion Day. 2,000 facial injuries that came in on that first day of the Battle of the Somme to one man in Sidcup in Kent. We went about reconstructing those faces. Now, what we do, and Danny's alluded to this, is not about making people look beautiful. It is about making people work in society. So looking normal in society is what everyone does, we try to do in our specialty. As a plastic surgeon, my day job at the NHS is cutting hearts and children walking face-shaped skulls. One of my major successes in life was being sent a tweet by a patient of mine who doesn't remember me. I treated her as a baby, and her mum said, "This bloke made your face better." And she's tweeting to say, "I've never met you, but I'd like to say thank you." And what we now know about facial attractiveness and facial deformation is actually, it doesn't matter on the surgeon's skills or what the surgeon does, what it matters is the family. And actually, what Danny's alluded to is, he didn't mention the family. The family is terribly important. I gave a talk a few years ago at the World Conference in London. And there was a girl guide who said there are three girls in my year in Cardiff, age 16, who are saving for breast implantation. That is a tragedy. And someone from the audience said, parents should use it for that. Parents knew nothing about it. And one thing about advertising, which we're doing, we try to get European standard in how people like me should perform in aesthetic surgery, stipulates that advertising should not be in a place where a child can see it in this type of market. For exactly the reason Dan said. So please don't think we're being responsible, because we're not. We have to remember that youth gives you the idea of fertility. Now, you're living to, most of the people in this room now live to 100, which is a pretty horrific thought. But actually, you want to remain healthy and fit and well and looking good. And by that, we mean not looking exhausted. You don't want people to come and say, my God, you look exhausted, you look tired. So please don't think looking good equates to looking different. You don't even mean to the Americans. The Americans, when the American plastic surgery wives get together at international meetings, they sit at a different table because they look huge. So good aesthetic surgery is not about making people look cute. It's about making people look better and more comfortable literally in their own skin. So I think we have to bear that in mind. Unfortunate female figure has been an object for 30,000 years. There are cave drawings, paintings and sculptures which date back. And they've worked out the hip-waist ratio in women and how it changes with time. And how the male brain perceives a hip-waist ratio as being someone who is able to procreate. The same applies the other way around. But unfortunately, women look at men in a slightly different way. And older men sometimes are looked as being more powerful and therefore perhaps able to pass their genes on more. So the evidence, I think, I'm afraid, is heavily against our position.
Yeah.
Science is heavily in favour of our motion. We're not suggesting it should be the be-all and end-all. If you think about the tax dollars, if tax was put on, VAT was put on to Botox and fillers, we could fund the gap in the health service at the moment. That is not a joke. It would bring in £2 billion revenue a year if that happened. That is how much is spent. And as part of the profession, I'm saying to the Chancellor, do this, mate. Come on. Ladies and gentlemen, sit down, but I'll ask you to vote for the motion.
I thank the honourable guest for his speech. I now turn to James Partridge to continue the case for the opposition.
Good evening, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. Like Professor Dorling, I too came extremely well attired. In my case, £250 worth of fine clothing. Yes, I like fine clothing. I enjoy wearing good-looking clothes, but I have absolutely no interest in owning lots of them. And I'm not very good at choosing them either. Nice clothes, shame about the face. Because yes, it's not pretty, is it? And of course, really not very good looking. Could do better. Severe burns I went through at 18, and my life here in the early 70s in Oxford as a student were very, very challenging. Hundreds of thousands of pounds were spent on me by taxpayers on fantastic plastic surgeons like Nigel to get my face to look okay. But not good enough, of course, because the prevailing orthodoxy, which I had swallowed as a child, yes, I swallowed it completely, the prevailing orthodoxy, which I suspect we all hold, would have it that without a good-looking face, I'm doomed to three nasty effects. The first, I won't feel very good inside. The first, I won't be, the second, I won't be liked by others. And thirdly, with scars as good or as bad as mine, I'm likely to live in the shadows. I should spend a lot more on looking good. Yes, not just on the moisturizers, but perhaps even on more cosmetic surgery, brilliant as it is, or perhaps even a face transplant. We live in a culture, ladies and gentlemen, which I think has swallowed hook, line and sinker this orthodoxy that looking good brings big rewards. It also imposes a very nasty stigma on people like me whose faces don't fit these norms of today, which I find profoundly unfair. It's a culture which we are bombarded with daily, strictly presented messages telling us why spending massively on looking good is not just good for our psyches, but it's absolutely vital for them. If we don't aspire to being spotless, wrinkle-free, ageless, really our sex lives will be poorer, our self-esteem lower, and our job and career prospects pretty much diminished. This was the orthodoxy that I had grown up with, and I think it is even more strongly conditioned into our youth today. The facts suggest that over 50,000 people in Britain choose to spend £500 million, something like that, on cosmetic surgery every year, and that across the beauty and the fashion industry, something like £70 billion a year is spent on looking good. Over £1,000 a person. Now, compare that with how much is spent on doing good, even on very generous assumptions about how much volunteering is worth. Yes, something like 25% of the population do volunteer, that's fantastic, and about 44% of the population do. But altogether, if you monetize the whole lot up, it comes to something like £35 billion a year, half of what is spent on looking good. So why am I against spending of so much, and certainly any more, on looking good? I am against this for three reasons. First, because I think the link between looking good and being successful, feeling good, being loved, is far more tenuous than anybody really understands. And it's positively dangerous too. I work with a lot of psychologists, and they confirm that self-esteem and confidence are very complex and they're hard for most of us to acquire. Research suggests that parental support, academic achievement, development of skills in all sorts of things, that's what brings us self-esteem and, to some degree, confidence. There are some people for whom their self-esteem is heavily dependent on their looks. Self-confidence, too, is gained by your ability to manage other people, to deal with their comments and their criticism. So do looks matter? Yes, of course they do. In the first 5 minutes of any new encounter, and incidentally I've been speaking for 5.5 minutes, and in the first 5 minutes, you will be taking me in, but as Professor Argyle of this great university told us so long ago, actually, you will have been pretty much impressed with my overall appearance, my gestures, my body language, the way I speak, how loud, how slow, how quiet. And my face will be of very little importance to you, about 4%, he estimated. Which isn't to say that looks are not important. They do matter enormously. But after those first 5 minutes, I don't think so. Sexual chemistry, it's not about some superficial stuff around the face or looking good, surely. It's a whole body, mind, spirit experience. Incidentally, the one statistic that I really do like around this subject is to go and have a look at the Hollywood divorces statistics. If you think that looking good and being happy is a really good correlation, it's not the case. But the dangerous bit too, let us not forget. Unfortunately, we are in a culture where the overzealous search for looking good has got very dangerous consequences. We've got epidemics of eating disorders, over-exercising, body dysmorphic disorder, self-harm. They're all on the rise in our society. And they are all the result of obsessive behaviour associated with the frustrated search for a perfect body. Research from Girl Guide found that 1 in 5 girls aged from 9 to 10 said that the way they look makes them feel most upset. And 39% of girls say that they experience demeaning comments about the way they look every week. These are unacceptable. I think, ladies and gentlemen, these are unacceptable social consequences of this look-good economy. We should be very careful about a culture that promotes ultra-thin models and eats lots too. We need to get a grip with this retail therapy world. So there is really something wrong with spending so much on looking good, it seems to me. But I also, the second reason I dislike this motion is that I don't like a culture which suggests that looking good is somehow morally good too. I dislike the flip side intensely. It suggests that people who look not very good are going to be villains and unpleasant characters. But the third and most important reason why I dislike this motion and oppose it is that it, in some ghastly way, suggests that doing good is not important. Looking good distracts monies from those incredibly important causes, some of which are local, some of which are international. And if that money were put into those causes, it would create so much good. Philanthropy, sadly, is in retreat, and yet the state is also backing away. We need to galvanise our society into giving much, much more. And in the process, people will get a buzz out. They will feel good about it. Mr. President, I move to oppose this motion very strongly. We are all opposed.
And ensure you speak into the microphone provided by the Secretary. Note that you have only up to 2 minutes to make your speech, so keep your points short and to the point. Can I look for a speech in proposition to the motion? A speech in proposition. Come on, don't be shy. Anyone to speak in proposition to the motion? No one at all.
Can we call on?
We can call upon someone if you like. No one would like to speak in proposition. Yes, the lady in the back row. Please come up to the dispatch boxes.
Becoming very serious numbers at the moment, so I'm quite gratitude. But it's also that it actually raises an enormous amount of money for philanthropic causes, which actually doesn't seem like. I don't sort of tell you about, but I know that from experience. There is a very, the industry's kind of official charity is Look Little Better, which goes into hospitals throughout the country, offering makeovers, in fact, to ladies that have, ladies, not only necessarily ladies, also gentlemen that have undergone cancer treatment and lost, and also patients treatment as well, lost their hair and generally are as an eyelashes and generally feel sort of quite alien. And that's 10,000 that they do each year, and that's supported by the beauty industry very generously. And companies, for example, such as Eti Lauder, and only the founder of the Breast Cancer Awareness Foundation, have raised $450 million. And for MAC Cosmetics, that's all their stars being in the department stores with the offering makeup, have actually raised $280 million for AIDS. But I know of other organisations, they're quite a big group that work for Alzheimer's and other brands that work for specifically people that would have very serious skin conditions. So I think that one thing that it does do is, yes, I can understand the price being paid about spending money on beauty products, but actually generating the sort of the revenue that it does, that they actually generate a huge amount of money for philanthropy. By the way, L'Oreal themselves have a worldwide program of supporting women in science, foundation with UNESCO, and they support Laureate International Foundation Awards every year. So there's an enormous amount of work that is generated through what in fact is some.
I thank everyone, the guests, for a speech. Now look for a full speech in opposition to the motion. Anyone in opposition? Yes, the gentleman on the aisle. Yes, please.
Thank you. I surely am only doing this because nobody else is speaking against the motion, and I do feel strong enough to get in front of you all and tell you why. So, I think what's underlying everything here is what we want as humans. What's our major focus? Where do we really want to go? Do we want to keep having all the self-immigrant diamonds and go on to keep more and more how wonderful we are? Or do we want to have a sense of community? There's a huge distinction between whether you act as an individual against everybody else wanting to be everybody, be number one, or whether you want to have a sense of community and getting along with other people. I think when you support the motion, you're getting back to the individual too much. And I think that's dangerous. I think when you go against the motion, you're looking more at we rather than I. So I came across something rather beautiful because I was a very competitive man when I was 20, and I just wanted to beat everybody at everything, and I thought I would. And life came along. There we go. Now, I have a view that we is more important than I. And so, I happen to read something in support of this view entirely. I read something, and I'm not religious, but I like this. I, first person singular, is the devil. First person plural is God. So what we're saying now is, when we think about ourselves, and we're so busy trying to beat everybody else, and we think my pleasure comes because I rise above everybody. It's kind of alienating. You're not with people. I've learned as a guy who's very competitive, back in Canada, I came to England, I learned to be a little more calm about things, which I appreciate. And I've realized now, more than ever, that people have a greater sense of pleasure when they're helping other people. That when you people go shopping, it is a pleasure. It's not a deep pleasure. You will only find deep pleasure when you're helping other people. That's what it's really all about. Thank you.
I thank the honourable guest for her speech and hereby close the floor debate. I turn to Sally Hughes to close the case for the proposition.
The House believes there is nothing wrong with spending more on looking good than doing good. The House is right.
Yeah.
Much was made in the opposition's argument about looking good not actually making us feel better. I spend my life around women, real women, who would categorically disagree, and some men. The fact is that looking good is important to many people. It is not frivolous. As we heard, we have an innate instinct to groom, and that's correct. But I know beauty lifts self-confidence, happiness, and can be extremely creative and empowering for many people. Not everyone, you don't have to join in, but for many people. Women's Refuge is a charity that I work with a lot. So at the end of every season, I get sent every beauty product under the sun. At the end of every season, when I have too many beauty products in my house, I give them to Women's Refuge. Women's Refuge consistently report to me that the change that makes in women's lives, women who have fled violence, violent home lives, who leave with nothing, with no self-respect, no belongings, no job prospects, and they turn up at Women's Refuge and they are given products, some that are just toiletries to keep them clean, some are things that are more luxurious, that make them feel nice. Some things are to make them look smart for job interviews. They make a massive difference to these women's lives. There are so many anecdotes I hear from readers that tell similar stories. So many. But I wanted to defer to the most moving story I think on this subject. It's an extract from the diary of Lieutenant Colonel Merlin Willett. He was the DSO in charge of the liberation of Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in May 1945. It was shortly after the British Red Cross arrived, though it may have no connection, that a very large quantity of lipstick arrived. This was not at all what we men wanted. We were screaming for hundreds and thousands of other things, and I didn't know who asked for lipstick. I wished so much that I could discover who did it, because it was an action of genius, sheer unadulterated brilliance. I believe women did more with those internees. I believe nothing did more for those internees than lipstick. Women lay in bed with no sheets and no nighty, but with scarlet red lips. You saw them wandering around with nothing but a blanket over their shoulders, but with scarlet red lips. I saw women dead on the post-mortem table, clutched in her hand was a piece of lipstick. At last, someone had done something to make them feel individuals again. They were someone, no longer merely the number tattooed on an arm. At last, they could take an interest in their appearance. Their lipstick had started to give them back their humanity. Anyone who dismisses beauty as an irrelevance and mere frippery for the shallow knows nothing of humanity and certainly knows nothing about women. Money spent on other things just don't draw the same criticism. It's not realistic to expect selflessness all the time. It's not unreasonable for people to spend the majority of their disposable income on themselves and their families while giving a percentage to charity. So what are the comparable notions? This House believes there's nothing wrong with spending more on holidays, cars, takeaways. We spend more on takeaways than we do on beauty, incidentally. If someone spends £10,000 on a car, do we ask them to consider how many pairs of waterproof trousers it could have bought for refugees in Calais? No. We accept that car as a necessary expense. But it's not. You could survive without it if you had to. Beauty is the same. It's not a matter of survival in most cases, but it is important to many. Perhaps the reason is that spending on our appearance seems a kind of superficial, narcissistic person by nature, the kind of person who spends their money on their appearance, is unintelligent, insensitive, has little regard for others. Those with an interest in service are perceived to have no depth. This happens to me daily. Which is why below-the-line commenters frequently wonder aloud how my readers and I can possibly justify spending £30 of our own hard-earned cash on moisturiser instead of inoculating the children of Darfur. They're amazed to hear me say that women are actually more than capable of having multiple interests while maintaining perspective. The women of my beauty forum, sense of community is incredible on that forum. Recently, they spent all day long talking about makeup, fashion, and much more substantial things. They recently swapped all their clothes, sold all their clothes and makeup to raise £8,000 for one of their own who had contracted cancer, who developed cancer. Which brings me neatly on to a little known fact about the beauty industry. The beauty industry bankrolls more medical research than practically any other industry in the world. In 2012 alone, Estée Lauder gave $40 million to 197 oncology scientists worldwide. And Moray Pacific Cosmetics in Korea donated their resources and facilities that became key in the development of Ketotop, an arthritic pain relief. L'Oreal USA funds research and technology in 3D tissue reconstruction for medical purposes. Are these entirely selfless acts? No, of course they're not. Are they doing it because they're lovely? No, it's not simply that. They're hoping for cosmetic breakthroughs. They're hoping for patents that they can apply for cosmetic purposes. But that research would not be taking place without my industry. It doesn't matter how we got there. They're just three examples of countless examples I could give of how the beauty industry and beauty as a whole does great good. The motion assumes there is a way of comparing spending, but doing good needn't cost anything at all. It assumes some sort of opportunity cost that money spent on looking good could be better spent on doing good. But doing good doesn't cost anything always. It's an unfair comparison. A volunteer might give one night a week to a soup kitchen, then spend 99 pence on a lip balm. They're already spending more money on looking good than doing good. How can you compare the value? The motion says there's nothing wrong. No one is saying you should spend more on your appearance. No one is forced to. There's no need to demonise and belittle those who think it important. They won't jeopardise the existence of charities. I almost didn't come tonight because a very close friend of mine has just died. I'm not looking for a sympathy vote. It's relevant. She would have been disgusted that I mentioned her. She died of osteosarcoma. She was supposed to have her leg amputated a couple of years ago, and she went into surgery. And before she went into surgery, the surgeon came round and said, when you wake up, you will still feel your leg. This will be very upsetting for you. I'm terribly sorry. You will go through intensive physio, and eventually you won't be able to feel your leg by morning, you know. She went into surgery. And when she came out, she could feel her leg, she couldn't dare look. The surgeon came round and said, have you looked? I managed to save your leg. When she rang me up the next day and told me this, I said, Christ, what do you do when a surgeon says we're losing your leg and you wake up and it's still there? And she said, I painted my toenails. And you understand that she was doing good, then you have no option but to vote for the motion.
I thank the honourable guest for her speech, and now turn to John Dixon to close the case for the opposition.
Some years ago, archaeologists discovered a pre-hominid jawbone in France that was estimated to be about 700,000 years old and belonging to a 45-year-old man. Now, because our ancestors had a very different diet, dental decay was not as common as it is now, so it's very odd that all the teeth were missing. And research showed that the teeth had been lost at varying intervals before life, and that the man had suffered from multiple abscesses, making eating painful and difficult. And unlike modern Provençal cuisine, most of the food then, most of the meat would have been tough and hard. Our man would almost certainly have been unable to masticate. And so the only way that he could have survived until the age of 45 was if others had chewed his food for him. Think about that at breakfast tomorrow. Now, if this is correct, this must be one of the first examples of charity in our history. All the evidence suggests that altruism is a deep-seated instinct. We're supposed to be charitable. We developed a biological need to help others because this was the best way to sustain and prolong life. Now, I define doing good as being charitable. I believe giving is good for us individually and good for society. Now, I'm all for people being attractive as possible. I'm rather keen on it. But the beauty industry is estimated to be worth 17 billion a year. I hope I've got my figures right. But I must tell you, actually, that personal giving by us as individuals is estimated to be just over 10 billion a year. So I regret to say we really are spending less on doing good than looking good. Now, why on earth should that matter? History tells us why. We know that the most successful and stable societies were those where the rich and powerful demonstrated commitment to their fellow citizens by being philanthropic. Now, their motives may have been suspect, but the outcome was generally very good. And the whole concept of charitable status began in 6th century Greece, when tax exemption was available on gifts to establish hospitals, orphanages and schools. Philanthropy became a badge of pride. And in 2nd century AD, Rome decreed that gifts of legacies should be made in perpetuity, providing the legal framework for the trusts and foundations we have today. And since then, philanthropy has shaped contemporary Britain. Hospitals, hospices, museums and galleries, theatres, libraries, parks, public gardens, and of course, great universities such as Oxford, were all originally funded by philanthropy and are all manifestations of a civilised society. Well, that was then. What about now? Now many people have little idea about the foundation of our contemporary society. Most people think that philanthropy has nothing to do with them. Well, we need to think again about giving and volunteering. Because the state is in retreat. The state will provide less over the next 5 or 10 years. It's not my job tonight to say whether this is a good or a bad thing. But I must point out that a smaller state has implications for the future of our civil society and our liberal democracy itself. A smaller state requires all of us, a response from all of us, if we are to maintain the fabric of society. Now, we like to describe ourselves as a generous nation, but here are some facts. Despite a colossal increase in personal wealth in Britain, charitable giving has not grown in real terms for 30 years. A parliamentary report in 2014 shows there's been a long-term decline in giving by households, from 32% of households in 1978 to 27% in 2010. Only 9% of us are responsible for two-thirds of all charitable giving. Coutts Bank reports that only 10% of those selling a business are engaged in significant philanthropy. And there's a survey of top-rate taxpayers, and almost half of them feel no obligation to give to charity. In 1987, there were 9 billionaires based in the UK, and now there are estimated to be 117. I must confess to being profoundly shocked that giving has not grown. Now, why should that matter? Try to answer these questions. What happens to civil society when the state is in retreat? How is it possible for the voluntary or social sector to compensate if charitable giving has not grown in real terms for 30 years and only a minority of the wealthy is philanthropic? Is a civil society and our liberal democracy sustainable In a more unequal world, while automation threatens jobs, youth unemployment remains high, fragmentary support for mainstream political parties, and an endemic lack of trust in authority and institutions. Are we sure that we will bequeath the civil society we enjoy to future generations who will live in an increasingly unequal world where liberal democracy might not prevail? The top 1% owns almost half the world's wealth. Will future generations inherit a plutocracy rather than a liberal democracy? Now, according to the Governor of the Bank of England, we are living in an age of irresponsibility. The cult of the individual and consumerism has brought us to a point where I believe humanity is losing the plot. And when we lose our humanity, when we ignore the needs of others and start to stigmatise them as something other, so that they become less than human, we're in trouble, for that way leads to violence, carnage and genocide. And if you're thinking I'm being alarmist, then consider this. 3 years before I was born, there was no civil society in most of Europe, and only 4 functioning democracies. Look at the world today, and the seeds of discord are not far away. There was genocide in Balkans only 20 years ago. How will Europe's flashpoint react to mass migration by people of different religion and ethnicity? So it's time to rebalance our priorities. The answer is to revive an old-fashioned concept, the common good. This concept ought to unite right and left. I define the common good as a sum of all the values, activities, and services that sustain our liberal democracy. We need to renew our commitment to the common good if our civil society is to survive, and that requires that we give money and time to others in addition to paying our taxes. In Victorian times, all classes engaged in philanthropy, as testified by Frank Picasso, the historian who's with us this evening. And we should try to revive that spirit, Victorian spirit of enterprise and philanthropy, whilst avoiding the hypocrisy, repression, poverty and squalor that blighted the 19th century. Perhaps the rash of beards and the mania for baking means that this is a sign we are recreating our Victorian heritage. I'm not making a plea to return to a rosy past that didn't exist. I'm looking forward to a future shaped by the experience of those who've gone before us. In conclusion, let us think about the most powerful impulses that have enabled the human species to flourish. We have to eat. If we eat well, we feel good. We have to make love, and if we do that well, we feel even better. And those who give will tell you that giving inspires a feeling of well-being that is like no other. And I know from personal experience that's true. I must also tell you that after 30 years of professional fundraising have taught me that the great majority of those who give, however plain or ugly, are more attractive and more lovable than those, and have more fun than those who do not. So those of you who are missing out, get in touch with the Oxford Community Foundation, start giving now, enjoy doing good, and vote against the motion.
I thank the honourable guest for his speech. The only thing left for us to do is to vote. Before we do so, I'd like to hand back to Jane Woodley to make a final comment.
Wow. Well, I'm going to ask you a question. How are you feeling? Have you changed your mind? No? Okay. I think we're feeling a bit worried. I don't know. I thought Sally did an excellent job. Really did a good job. Danny was getting worried next to me. He was thinking, we've lost it. We've lost it now. Then John came along. It is a really interesting topic. And I think we've learned that debating isn't really about the right or wrong. It's just trying to get to a truth that we all feel comfortable with. And we are all different. So, are you ready to make lots of noise?
So I think we've got a treat this morning, haven't
we? We do indeed. Tonight we'll be voting by acclamation. So when the time comes, can all those in proposition please say aye as loudly as you can. And all those in opposition, please say nay as loudly as you can. So all those in proposition, could you please say aye now?
Aye!
Is that aye? No. And all those in opposition, can you please say nay now?
Nay!
Aye! And all those in opposition, could you please say nay?
Nay!
I'm afraid I believe nays have it. The motion. Hereby close the debate.